On today's episode, I have a conversation with Jared Berggren. Many of you will recognize Jared from his time playing at the University of Wisconsin for Coach Bo Ryan less than 10 years ago. We dig into Jared's career path, the unique experiences he's had overseas, how the game has impacted his life, and ultimately how he is passionate about giving back to current players as we work alongside each other at Catalyst Training. I had the opportunity to train Jared during the last 3 years of his playing career, and I've watched him navigate life as a player, as a trainer, a husband, and a dad. We cover all of those topics, and I really think you will enjoy this conversation. But before we get started, this podcast is a branch of The Film Room, a free coaches educational platform on our website, basketballcatalyst.com. The Film Room features skill development breakdowns, team drills, offensive and defensive concepts, a guest blog, and so much more. Head to basketballcatalyst.com/filmroom for more information. Here's Jared Berggren. All right, we're on with Jared Berggren today. Jared, like we said, is a former Wisconsin Badger, great, and played overseas for 6 years, and he's going to talk a little bit about that. But before we get started, in the spirit of the bowl season and national championships and all of that, I don't know, Jared, if you saw Jimmy Johnson, former NFL coach, they surprised him on air on Sunday and said that he was invited into the NFL Hall of Fame. So in that spirit, how does it feel to be the newest member of the Wisconsin basketball all-decade team?
Wow, what an honor. I think I got about one vote for the team, and that might have been me.
You might have been the only guy that voted for yourself.
Yeah, well, no shame here. No, but when you play behind some, you know, or in the same program with some guys like Frank Kaminsky, John Lure, Jordan Taylor, you know, some of these great, great players, Sam Decker that came through Wisconsin, to even be in the conversation, you know, as one of the better players in the last decade, it is pretty cool. So that was kind of fun to see.
Yeah, you know, we can talk about this a little bit more down the road, but it is fun to watch. You know, myself, I've talked about it before that I'm a big Badger fan, but to watch how you guys stay connected. You know, we talked even this summer with Cole Aldrich, and he made a comment about, like, how cool he thinks it is that the Wisconsin guys stay together, whether you guys are getting together for weddings in the summer or whatnot, but even just the other day with John Lure in the gym and Tim Jarmus at St. Thomas helping us out. I mean, Jordan Taylor, Brusewitz, you guys seem to always find a way into the gym in the summer. So I do think what you guys had there is pretty cool.
No, it's very cool. And I've, you know, playing overseas, talking to guys from other colleges and stuff, like, most guys' experience is not nearly what ours is at Wisconsin. So when I see guys that are, like, in the consideration of going to Wisconsin, obviously I'm biased by looking. I'm like, how could you not want to play there?
Yeah.
So now I'm going to turn this into a little recruiting pitch here. But,
go ahead.
But no, I mean, it's real, though. Like, it's our connection is just crazy. And it's, you know, the other day, actually, when we were in the gym, then our old trainer texted me out of the blue. I haven't talked to him in years, but it's like, you know, Henry's the man. Like, I'll go see him. You know, saw him last summer at a wedding. It's like, you see these guys, even if it's years in between, you see him, and it's like, you didn't skip a beat. Like, they're really just family. So we have something very special there that, you know, I'm very thankful for, that I had the opportunity to play there. And, you know, you see some of the other Minnesota guys that have come in recent years with Brad Davison. I've met him a couple times, and just like that, it's like, I feel like if he reached out to me and he needed anything, like, I would 100% want to help him out. Same, you know, Ben Carlson, a guy that's committed there now. Met him one time earlier this season, watching him play.
Yep.
And it's like, I immediately just, you're part of the Wisconsin family. I know he's going to fit right in. You know, again, like I said, not to turn this into a complete recruiting pitch here, but it's, you know, there's something very special there that, you know, like I said, very, very thankful that I was a part of that.
Well, I do have to chuckle the other day when we're in the gym and you're taking John through a warm-up. And he goes to shoot some free throws after the warm up, and he simply, like, bent over, like, he's getting loose, and it, Tim out of nowhere is like, "Are you out of shape?" Like, no, no. He's getting, but it's just funny because you guys are like buddies and like you're in a
it's
gym.
It's like brothers, man.
Yeah.
It's like brothers just needling at each other all the time and just, you know, talking trash and just kind of, you know, pressing the right buttons to get them mad. But it's, you know, that's our relationship with all those guys. And it's, you know, it's even guys that I didn't even necessarily play with. Like
yeah.
Greg Steamsman was one of them. We didn't have any overlap. He graduated the year before I came in.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'll see Greg in the summer or whenever. And it's, you know, we're hugging it out. And, you know, it's like we're, you know, long lost brothers here. It's with everyone, whether we play together or not. There's a really special bond between all of us.
Yeah. And we could go down. We're going to save this for another podcast. But, you know, it's fascinating. I was actually last night on the phone with Brad Davidson for over an hour. And we were just talking about like culture, the culture, the program, the leadership. And I think that's a testament to the things that Coach Ryan did, you know, and starting going back, you know, with Coach Bennett to Coach Ryan. And now some of the stuff that Coach Gard and his staff are doing is pretty cool to be able to maintain some of those relationships 10, 12 years down the road that you see a guy, you're like, hey, that guy's a badger. As we kind of get started, you know, you and I met, you know, probably 12 years ago, working Wisconsin, when I was working Wisconsin camps and you were a player. Mm-hmm. I think it is kind of, you know, kind of funny how I met all you guys and now end up working with you, which is pretty cool. But met you about 12 years ago and then got reconnected probably 4 or 5 years ago.
Right.
When I would come back from New Jersey to work out with you and Cole Aldrich and some of those guys. But, you know, as we were kind of, I think, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but drawn to each other because we kind of have a similar upbringing, you know, smaller towns, blue collar, stuff like that. So tell us a little bit of kind of the start of your basketball journey.
Yeah. So just to give you kind of a quick rundown, of where I came from, grew up in Princeton, Minnesota, small town, about an hour northwest of Minneapolis. And I always loved basketball, but honestly, I wasn't that serious about it until probably my sophomore year of high school.
Yeah.
I just didn't know. I wasn't exposed to anything. I was just kind of in my own little world out in Princeton, like, you know, sheltered from what was out there. And my sophomore year, we had a senior on the team, Scott Rail, who ended up playing at Southwest State, Minnesota. Really good D2 player, but he was getting looks by a lot of D2 schools, and they kind of started, you know, they're in the gym watching him, and then they see this, you know, tall, skinny sophomore on the team. They're like, oh, this big guy, he might end up pretty good. And then they start asking my high school coach, you know, where am I playing AAU? And I didn't know anything. I knew of AAU obviously, but I didn't play anything, you know. And then they're like, oh, you should play with Howard Pulley. That was really the top program in the state at the time. And
yeah,
so we got me plugged in after the season there to, you know, figure out when tryouts were. Went down there. First couple minutes, they have us scrimmaging. I play against Trevor Mbakwe, who went on to play, you know, for the Gophers and played overseas for a long time. And going against him, he was 1 year older than me. I think he like spun on me, dunked on my head, and I'm like, oh boy, like this is not what I'm used to playing in little old Princeton. And
yeah,
you know, I guess I held my own because we went back and battled back and forth and ended up making the team. They ended up putting me on the top 17 under team as a 16-year-old. So I was playing up on the, you know, on the top team. And a couple weeks later, we're playing in tournaments against, you know, Blake Griffin and all these top players in the country at these big AAU tournaments. And it really just opened my eyes to what was out there for the world of basketball. And within that next year, really even 6 months, my whole life basically changed. Cause it, you know, I went from just being a, you know, I'm more or less a big fish in a small pond in Princeton, and then seeing what's out there and getting exposure on the national level and getting recruited by a handful of Big Ten teams and teams around the country. And by right around New Year's of my junior year. So yeah, probably about 6 months after all this, I committed to Wisconsin and, you know, kind of changed my life from there.
That is, it's funny. I mean, it's interesting growing up similar. Like we just didn't have opportunities in small towns. Like I look at these kids being based in the Twin Cities and like the amount of opportunities that kids have today, you know, I can't speak for you, but for myself, when we got an opportunity, like we got to play in like two tournaments a summer with our high school team. Like mm-hmm. we played like eight games, So like, it was like our Super Bowl. You got a July tournament. Like, I remember coming down and Eric Carlson at Shakopee, who was committed to North Dakota State. We were like, we got Shakopee. Like, what are we going to, and he, you know, he didn't even show up. I don't know if he had an injury or something, but we're like,
you probably had bigger stuff going on.
Like, but there was no social media. There was none of that. So we showed up and we're like, all right, which one of those guys over there is Carlson? Because we didn't know, but we knew, like, oh, Shakopee was a big school, but I don't know. So
yeah, it's a different world now. Cause it's great, but I think there's pros and cons to it. But now AAU has grown so much that everyone has an opportunity, which is obviously great. I think the some of the cons to it would be that there is some, you know, kind of some bad programs out there. I think there's some programs that more or less try to take advantage of kids or just, you know, kind of collect money and say, oh yeah, go play, do whatever you want. Which, I mean, you can spin it as a good thing if you want to. I mean, it is giving kids opportunities. So that's, you know, not here to trash on anyone that's doing that. But it's a completely different culture than what, you know, what it was when I was coming up. And, you know, it was already going before, you know, at that point. It was 2006 for me, I guess, when I kind of got into it. And what it is, you know, in the last 13, 14 years here is just grown incredibly. It's just a different beast now.
Well, and I think too, there are some benefits to being a small town kid. There are some disadvantages. I know, like right now, it's been really cool to watch Nate Heisey, who I've worked with a little bit out of Lake City, like small town, just committed to Northern Iowa. And everyone, you know, he's putting up these stats because he's in a small town. It's like, he had like 5 dunks as a point guard the other day in the first 6 minutes of the game, and they were all in the half court. Like, the kid can play. But there's always going to be that, he's a small town. He's not playing against anybody. And so I can't imagine, you know, I played in the top 100 expo and did some things. Actually, my team, we joke about it. We were so bad that they split us up. And they were like, oh, these, you know, the guys were putting their JV stats down. Guys averaging 17 a game. Well, yeah, you put 17 a game on the JV, but the team was myself, Mike Brusewitz as a sophomore, and Nate Walters. And we were awful, but it was funny. It was like, that was my first experience at a big thing like that. And it was like, oh, you know, this guy he's like, oh, he's okay. He's like, okay, like this guy's going to be a first or second round draft pick. But I'm from a small town and I've never seen anybody that can do the stuff that you can do. So it was an eye-opening experience. So tell us, you know, you made the commitment to Wisconsin. You get to Wisconsin. What was that like? I mean, you get the shell shock of like, hey, I got to go against someone like Trevor in high school. Now I'm getting like, this is a Big Ten.
Right. So it's seeing guys like Trevor every night, you know, in the Big Ten and, you know, every day in practice. So it was when I got there as a freshman, I didn't know what to expect. They didn't, you know, tell me right off the bat, like, oh, you're going to redshirt your freshman year. You're going to play your freshman year. Like that was never Coach Ryan, that was never his philosophy. He was always like, I'm going to give you a chance to compete. And it's kind of up to you to, you know, if you prove it to yourself or prove it to us that you can compete, we'll give you the opportunity. And my freshman year, I ended up redshirting. My next year, so then my freshman year of eligibility, kind of in the same boat. So I had basically what it was, I had John Luehr and Keaton Ankeville, where John played in the NBA for the last 8 years now, I think. And Keaton, he's played overseas he had probably 5 or 6 years overseas playing high level. And those guys were, you know, they're older than me, they're more experienced. And I was, you know, I kind of had to pay my dues, and I would get, you know, spot minutes here and there as a freshman, as a sophomore, a little bit more, but still, you know, kind of inconsistent. I think as a sophomore, I think I started like one game, then the next game I like didn't play at all, you know, so it was just kind of the way it went for me. And then, you know, I think, and especially the way things are today, I think a lot of guys would be really frustrated by that. Obviously I was frustrated, but I stuck it out. I never even considered transferring. You know, I think in today's climate, the way things are, like guys, you know, have a hard year or two and they're like, oh, this isn't it. Like, they're not giving me a chance. I'm transferring.
Yep.
And I'm extremely glad I never even considered that. I mean, that's just not, you know, who I am as a person. But I really had to pay my dues for essentially 3 years until John and Keaton graduated. And then finally my junior year, you know, it was more or less my time to step into that the starting, you know, five spot at Wisconsin, and started every game as a junior, senior. Senior year, I think I ended up making like second team All Big Ten, made the All Big Ten defensive team. And that's really just a credit to the way they, you know, organize things at Wisconsin, the way they develop players at Wisconsin. Like, it's, you know, like I said, that's the culture.
Yep.
It's extremely common for guys to redshirt there. I think we probably redshirt more than anyone in the country.
Yep.
So, you know, it's just kind of the way it was. You got to pay your dues and earn the right to, you know, to step into that role and just developed over time. And by the end of my senior year, I was considered a guy that was, you know, at least on the radar of NBA teams. After I finished my senior year, I signed with Priority Sports Agency based in Chicago. Same agency John Lewis is with, Sam Decker, a ton of high-level NBA guys and overseas guys. And so I ended up moving down to Chicago, training there for a couple months, and then went through, I'm not even sure how many teams I worked out for, probably 12 to 15 NBA teams that I got in front of and worked out with and interviewed with. Draft came. A couple teams were considering drafting me with a late second round pick. Ended up going undrafted. And then Orlando Magic invited me to play on their summer league team, played with them. When that summer league finished, I went out to Vegas and played with Cleveland. Nothing really came out of it. You know, it was a good opportunity to compete, but it was, you know, I think I had a chance to go to training camp with a couple teams, but it would have been kind of deal where, you know, 99% chance I end up on their D League team or G League as it's called now. So I ended up taking a deal, guaranteed deal, 2-year deal in Belgium with a really good team there in Oostende, Belgium. So went out there, played for 2 years, won the championship both years out there, played with some really good players, a really great coach out there. They've won the championship in Belgium for, I think, 8 years now, maybe nine, I think 8 years in a row now. So just a really high-level team out there that just taught me a lot about playing professional basketball, and then kind of sprinkled in a couple more experiences with NBA Summer League in the offseason again with Detroit and Milwaukee. So I was kind of on the verge of, you know, cracking into the NBA, but just couldn't quite get over the hump, and, you know, continued to play overseas. 2 more years in Italy, 1 year in Japan, and then the last season was playing in Switzerland. So I've had a pretty good run of things over these last 6 years of playing professional basketball. That's been some really unique experiences.
Yeah, totally. I you talked about your development at Wisconsin and kind of having to pay your dues. You know, you mentioned Frank Kaminsky, and Frank's a guy that, like, you, I think you've said this before, that you were the all-time leader in blocks at Wisconsin until Frank came in. But Frank's another great example of a guy that really was a nobody, right? And I remember seeing when he had like 44 points against, I think it was UW Green Bay, it was like, who? Like,
yeah.
And really his development.
Right. Yeah. So that's almost my claim to fame now. When I tell people I played at Wisconsin, people that, you know, younger kids or whatever that I'm training now, and they don't remember, it's like, yeah, well, you ever heard of Frank Kaminsky? They're like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, Frank was my backup. So that's my little way to, you know, like I said, my claim to fame now. But yeah, Frank, when he came in, he was a, you know, tall, skinny, goofy kid that, you know, you looked at him, you're like, okay, he's skilled. He can shoot a little bit, and he'd have his days in, you know, open gym playing in the summer. It's like, Frank will come down, hit a three, then he'll pump fake, drive to the rim, spin move, finish at the rim. You're like, okay, what's going on? And then he'll come down, hit another three. And it's like, well, all right, Frank's on one today. Like, this is crazy. And then all of a sudden, you know, and he'd have flashes like that. We'd have a couple good games. He'd play well. But, you know, like I said, you got to pay your dues. And he was kind of, you know, in that role where he was playing behind me for his freshman, sophomore year. And then when I graduated, you know, similar to what I did, then his junior year, he stepped into that main role and just really exploded. Like you said, he had that huge game early in the season, kind of put him on the radar, and then he just kept doing it, you know, through the Big Ten season, in the NCAA tournament, led him to the Final Four, doing it against, you know, the top teams in the country, and it was so fun to watch. I was actually in Belgium then. I think, I can't remember if it was the first year or second year, because then my first 2 years, they went to the back-to-back Final Fours.
Yep.
Which, when I tell people I played at Wisconsin, they're like, oh, you went to the Final Four? No, I missed those
years. My backup took them.
Right, yeah, right. So, no, I like to think we, you know, laid the groundwork a little bit, and then they figured out how to kick the door down and you know, get over the hump. But no, actually, I think it was the second time they went to the Final Four. We were playing in the Belgian Cup, which is kind of a mid-season tournament, which we actually won that both years too. So this, I think it was the second year we won the cup championship, and then we went out, we're celebrating with the team. And then, you know, at about 3 a.m., whatever, with the time difference, the Badger game was coming on. They were playing in the national championship against Duke.
Yep.
So I was like, all right, I got my championship. I'll go home, you know, stay up late, watch my boys get their championship. And obviously they ended up losing that one in a real tough game to Duke. But it was some fun nights of, you know, staying up late. It actually kind of wreaked havoc on my sleep schedule here for a couple weeks through the NCAA tournament when these guys are making those runs to the Final Four, and I got to stay up late, you know, stay up till 4 or 5 a.m. watching these games. It was hard on me, but it was fun stuff.
That's funny that you have – that's your, you know, story of Minnesota native Tyus Jones beating the Badgers. And,
yeah, right.
And as he's like, okay, well, if anyone's going to beat the Badgers, at least it was a Minnesota guy. But I'm living in New York. I actually have just moved across the river to Jersey City, New Jersey, like 3 months away from getting married, and I'm watching the game. Like I don't know the area. Like I don't have a TV set up yet. Like I have a couch and my laptop. I'm stealing my landlord's internet. He's like, yeah, you can use the internet. And at halftime, the internet goes out. And so I've had a couple beverages, so I'm not going to get in my car, and I don't really know the area. It's a very inner city area. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, I have to watch this game. Like I am a diehard Badger fan, and I look up this like sports bar, and the Yelp review, I kid you not, was my favorite place to go that you're most likely to get shot. And that's what it said. But it was the only thing within Great. Jogging distance, and there was like 9 minutes to go in the halftime thing. So in my red sweatshirt, Wisconsin crew neck, I ran a mile, and I got there, and there was a guy from St. Peter's Division I school in Jersey City, and he sat down next to me, and he said, "You're not from here, are you?" And I said, "No." And he's like, "You got anything on underneath that?" I said, "What do you mean?" He's like, it's kind of gang territory. You might not want to wear a red sweatshirt. So I watched Tyus Jones beat us, and then I ran home about like 1.2 miles in the middle of March in a white undershirt, freezing my butt off because I didn't want to be the guy. I had no idea where I was, obviously.
Nice.
So, yeah. So you mentioned, you know, playing summer league. And then having an opportunity to go to training camp. You know, if you could talk a little bit about this, I get asked this all the time. You know, and the NBA has done some really cool things to promote the G League, getting sponsors, and now almost every team has a G League team. But, you know, you get a training camp invite, and I get a lot of people like, well, why wouldn't he take that? And so, you know, obviously there's guaranteed money and stuff overseas. And non- go through... If you could talk a little bit about why you wouldn't take a potential training camp deal and why you would just head overseas.
I think the first thing you have to understand is in 2013, when I was going through this, the D League at the time was different than what it is today. So today it's been growing like crazy over the last, you know, 6-7 years here. So at the time, I think the D League salary was something like $25,000. Like it was, you know, it
before
wasn't
taxes,
right, before taxes. And overseas, you know, you sign a deal, it's after taxes, everything, whatever you sign for, you essentially take everything home because the team, you know, they're going to give you a place to live, they're going to give you a car, they pay the, you know, the taxes for that country, which basically applies to your American taxes, not to get into all those boring details. But you essentially take everything home. So it was, you know, pretty significantly, you know, financially better for me to take a deal overseas. And now, you know, in today, if it was right now doing it, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'd stay home with the same situation because now they've increased the salary in the G League. They have different kind of tiers to what contract you have. Like they have more two-way spots, which is much easier, you know, for you to get called up. And they have I'm not exactly sure on all the details of it, but I think they have a couple different designations that you can make, you know, quite a bit more money. Uh-huh. So it's definitely more of an incentive, where I think it's really smart by the NBA to promote that and make it a true kind of farm system for the NBA. Because it was much more financially profitable for me to go overseas. And, you know, for me, it just made sense. Yep. Going to Belgium, which is actually, here's another little fun story about it. When I went to Belgium, I had actually been to Belgium with Howard Pulley, with my AAU team, when I was in high school. So me and Jordan Taylor, Matt Janning, another Minnesota guy, played at Northeastern College, played in the NBA for a little bit, still playing overseas, some really high-level teams now. We all took a trip to Belgium with our AAU team, which is super rare. Like, people don't do that. Honestly, I don't really know how it was set up or why it was set up, frankly, but it was a really cool experience. That so when I got to Belgium, I'm telling these guys, like, yeah, I've been here before. I remember pictures. So Ostend, the city I was in, is right on the coast of the North Sea in Belgium. So I remember looking at these pictures. When I signed in Belgium, I went back in my, you know, old pictures and found, yeah, we were at that beach, played. I don't think we played at our main arena. We played at some other, like, smaller gyms around there.
Yeah.
But I actually played against one of my teammates. Where I'm talking, I was like, yeah, I came here when I was like 16, and this one of the Belgian guys was like the same age as me. He's like, dude, I think I played against you. I'm like, yeah, and we're talking about like where we played in the gym and stuff like that. He's like, dude, we definitely played against you. So just like really small world with stuff like that I actually, you know, was there playing against, you know, some of my future teammates. And but yeah, so just to go overseas was kind of the right move for me. And then it still left me opportunities where, like I said, I had a 2-year deal, but I had kind of some outs in it where first year when I came back, if I got on a summer league team and if a team wanted to bring me to camp, I could get out of my contract.
Uh-huh.
Actually, that next summer, I ended up tearing my meniscus in my knee and I ended up having surgery that next summer, which I kind of dealt with my whole rookie year, which was kind of a major disappointment. My first year professional to deal with injuries kind of the whole time. So it still had some flexibility while still, you know, getting a guaranteed deal and playing really high level teams. We played in the Euro Cup, which, if you know anything about European basketball, there's essentially three levels. There's the Euro League, which is the top 16, or I think it's maybe 18 teams now. That it's all, you know, it's a ton of like NBA level guys that either played in the NBA and then, you know, couldn't stick around, went overseas, or guys that, some guys even choose, you know, they'd rather stay overseas, you know, European guys. Mirotić, the guy from when he played the Bulls, he just, you know, he turned down a deal in the NBA. A
massive contract in the NBA.
Yeah, to go play for, you know, one of the top teams in Spain. So it's, you know, there's guys that, you know, almost prefer to play overseas like that. So it's really high level stuff. And we played in the Euro Cup, which is essentially the second division of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, played against some really high level guys, played against Kristaps Porzingis. I think that was my second year. That was the year before he came to the NBA. So it was him. It was Willie Hernan Gomez was on the same team, the guy who played for the Knicks for a while. I think for the Hornets for a while. I'm not sure where else.
And didn't you guys smack them?
This was honestly one of the most unique stories ever. So we beat them. We're playing in Spain at their place, and we beat them by like 30. Yeah. And this was in the second round of Euro Cup. And apparently, so that team was doing well in Euro Cup, but they're also playing in the Spanish league and they were doing terrible there. Like, they were in almost last place in the Spanish league there. So their fans were really frustrated with them. So they started like sarcastically cheering for us and it just kept building and building. We got like a steal, like in a breakaway dunk, and their crowd is going nuts. I'm like, what is happening here? So another guy that was there was a Minnesota kid, Ben Woodside.
Yeah,
And I knew him a little bit. He's actually with the same agency and stuff. And I'm like, Woody, what's going on, man? Your crowd's cheering for us. He's like, dude, the fans are turning on us. They're so mad we keep losing in the Spanish league. He's like, they're turning on us. I'm like, dude, this is wild. So that was one of the most unique stories, I guess, I have, having the, yeah, playing against some future NBA players and having their crowd cheer for us. That's pretty interesting.
Well, I think, you know, and I do want to have you back on and talk through some of the crazy like intricacies of overseas basketball. You know, you full-time basketball player, part-time international tax expert. you end up like, I know a couple years ago, Nate Walters was overseas, and you mentioned previously like a mid-season tournament, and you're like what? So like I think you had a thing in Switzerland last year where you play and you win this tournament, and you're like, hey, this is awesome, like it's your championship, and then you have to like stay around for another 2 months to play like in this other
Right. There's some really, like last year in Switzerland was really weird because they had two cups. So they had, and then it was like the Swiss Cup, and then it was like the Swiss Cup of the league. I'm like, what? What are you talking about? So you had two basically tournaments that were running like throughout the season.
Yeah.
So yeah, it takes time to actually, the NBA is talking about adopting stuff like that, which I think it can be cool. Like in Italy, the way they did it, I think was probably my favorite. They had, you played the first half of the regular season, and then they take the top eight teams from that in the standings, and then you just play a regular eight team, you know, single elimination tournament, which was a really cool event. And the NBA is actually talking about adopting something like that. And most of the stuff I've seen, people are like, what? This is stupid. What are you talking? And it's, I understand it is different, but having, you know, gone through it and gotten used to it over the last 6 years overseas, I think it's actually pretty cool if people would be, you know, be open to it. You know, I think it's pretty cool. So it takes some getting used to. But yeah, the stuff in Switzerland last year was extra weird because there was two of them. So it'd be like, okay, this is a cup game. Well, like, what cup? And they'd be like, the Patrick Baumann Cup or whatever, and this would be the SBL Cup, and this would be that. I'm like, well, I can't keep which one is straight here. So I was just like, all right, just we have a game. Okay, cool. Let's go play.
Yeah, no, totally. I'm trying to like keep track of different things or in understanding too how it works with citizenship and imports. And so what I think is super interesting is that you can be a guy overseas, and I know you're gonna talk about a little bit of your hardships that you've gone through and the lessons that you've learned. But if a team gets two imports, meaning they don't have a passport, you could be averaging like 18 and 12 and get cut, and you might be leading the team in scoring. But if somebody else got hurt and they need to use an import, or you know, an old NBA guy becomes available, or you know, even some things that don't make any sense logically, like, oh,
right,
you're there. We only get a point guard and a big. That's what our GM has chosen to use. And
right
now I'm gone.
Yeah. It's there's some really crazy stuff with that. Every country has their own rules on, yeah, how many, you know, import players. Or so like in Belgium, for example, you had to have on your roster of 12 players, six of them had to be Belgian, and then six of them could be from anywhere else. So they could be other European countries or American or whatever. Uh-huh. In Italy, they had even kind of stranger rules where it was you could have like seven Italians, and then you could have like three like European non-Italians. So they had to be from other like EU countries, and then two Americans, or you could have six, and like I'm gonna butcher what the exact rules were, but it was like they had different options where you could like make up your team different ways. In Japan, they had, when I was there, you could have three Americans or three, you know, import players, but only two. So you could have three of them, but in the first quarter, only one of them could be on the floor. In the second quarter, two could be on the floor. Third quarter, one. Fourth quarter, two. So it's like there was only 60 total minutes available to split up between three guys. So it was just really goofy. So yeah, I don't know. There's different rules in each country that gets a little bit. Last year in Switzerland was you could have four, but you had to have two Swiss players on the floor at all times. So you could have three Americans, and then you could, you know, so it's like the makeup of the team was always interesting. Like, what do you have for local players? What do you need for imports? In Japan, they'd only sign big guys. There was no like American guards there. It was all like four fives, or maybe you'd have kind of a wing, like a big wing would be kind of a 3-4 combo, but it was all big guys because it's, you know, that's kind of what they needed. That's what most teams were signing. They needed to compete with that. So it was just the way the league went. It was just really unique stuff you see in different countries, different styles of play. And it can also, you know, and that can really, you know, help or hurt you, all about your fit. So kind of what you said, diving into kind of my struggles and more or less tying it into how, you know, where it led me today. when I went to Japan, I really struggled with that because it was, they wanted the American, you know, your imports to be one-on-one, you know, throw the ball inside, play one-on-one, go score. And, you know, anyone that, you know, may have watched me play at Wisconsin, that's just not really me. You know, it's not the way we play. It was all about, you know, being versatile, moving the ball, sharing the ball with your teammates, you know, pick and pop, space the floor. Of course, post up sometimes, but it wasn't, you know, that wasn't my bread and butter, you know, just go one-on-one in the post. So I struggled there. Just the fit was not right at all. And halfway through the year, we hit a losing streak, lost a couple games. Team decided, you know, they weren't happy. They cut me, sent me home. So that's actually what kind of led us to where we are today, where I ended up coming home. It was actually really tough overall because it was right after my daughter was born. The day after she was born, we're still in the hospital. She's about 15 hours old. My agent calls, says, "Hey, we got a deal in Japan." I'm like, "Okay, cool. Like, do we have some time to decide on this?" Yeah, you probably got a day. I'm like, dude, I need to decide if I'm going to move to Japan in about 2 weeks, like 15 hours after my daughter's born.
And I just became a dad.
Right. So it was kind of from then, it just felt different if I wanted to keep, you know, bringing my family overseas. And like I said, then I went there and frankly just struggled, you know, with the style of play, with my, you know, my mental approach. I lost my confidence, you know, when I was struggling. I just wasn't happy. My wife wasn't happy. And then I came home, and for about a month I was home without a team, and we were working out together. And I remember having this conversation, and I'm like, "Reed, like, I don't know how long I can do this, man. Like, it just, we're not happy." And you're like, "Well, what do you want to do when you're done playing?" I said, "I want to do what you do. I want to stay in the gym. I want to, you know, I want to help, you know, young players get better. There's just, it's such a rewarding thing for me to, you know, to be able to stay in the gym and kind of pass on what I've learned through my career." And that's kind of what planted the seed for us to start working together. And I think at the time you were like, "Great," because, you know, your business was getting bigger than you could handle on your own, and you wanted to bring someone in. And I think we had the conversation. You said, you know, you wanted it to be the right guy, which, you know, I'm extremely, extremely grateful and fortunate that you decided that right guy was me. And then that's, so then I ended up going back to Japan with a different team, which actually was a much better fit. But played there for the rest of the season, came home that summer, and then we kind of hit the ground with, all right, I still wanted to play. I didn't want to end my playing career on such a sour note.
Yep.
So I went through that summer still training for myself to, you know, to get ready to play. Ended up taking a deal in Switzerland. But during that summer, we'd work out together, and then I would kind of help, you know, kind of help you out with some of the youth workouts and just kind of get my feet wet and learning the game from the other side, from a trainer standpoint. And that kind of is where this all started with us working together and trying to build something and just progress the game of basketball, you know, with our company here.
Yeah. No, I think a lot about that conversation when you came back after they cut you in Japan. And, you know, like that getting cut, right? The idea of that, like, oh, embarrassing or whatever. Like, it happens all the time. Like, this is, like, it's not like you get fired from a job because you're acting like an idiot or like being irresponsible. It's just like, this is a very difficult game and you're asked to perform. And if they're not happy, then you have to adjust. It doesn't mean you're not good enough. But at the same time, as a player, like, you came back and I didn't write up a workout because I knew we weren't going to work out. We were in the gym for over 2 hours that day. I think you probably shot about 7,000 15-foot jumpers, and I just listened and you talked. And I think, like, from a, like, just a psychological standpoint, like, you needed that. And I anticipated that you were going to need to be able to talk, but it was those questions like, "Jared, what are you going to do?" And then ultimately, as a competitor, I remember you were at that point, you were ready, I think, to hang it up that day. And I said something about you're going to want to go out on your own terms.
Right.
And the next day you came to work out and you were so excited. Like, you wanted to run through a brick wall. It was so funny. I'm like, this dude wanted to hang it up yesterday. Right. And today, And it was like, I think you were struggling from the free throw line, and you're a good free throw shooter, but I think you were shooting like mid 40s. You go over there.
I just had nothing. I don't know. I had the yips. I don't know what it was, but I was struggling in every way. I mean, I couldn't in practice. I couldn't make a 6-foot jump shot. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't catch the ball. I couldn't shoot free throws. I was completely, you know, just out of rhythm and with no confidence and, you know, struggling on the court, struggling off the court, just being unhappy, you know, being in a different place overseas and, you know, not the best living situation, not the best, you know, playing situation, hard times adjusting with a newborn baby and my wife coming over. So I went over there by myself about 2 weeks after my daughter was born. And then for the first, I don't know, 6 weeks or so, my wife and daughter stayed home, kind of let me get settled in, get through preseason. And then they came out. You know, once she got, you know, maybe 2 months old, you know, which was tough on everyone, tough on the family and, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles, all that stuff that want to be around, you know, my daughter and my wife. And, so it was hard. So that was a point where things really just felt different. But like you said, I think it was something where, just the competitor in me that, once I went through that, it was like, okay, I can't let one, you know, sour situation end my career. Uh-huh. You know, I gotta go out on my own terms. And, you know, so I worked hard that summer and ended up getting a spot in Switzerland and, you know, gave it one more go at least to, yeah, like you said, kind of end on my own terms at least.
You know, you and I have talked about like basketball and the things that it teaches you. And I actually looked up the stat and, I think that Fortune magazine says that they estimated that like 95% of Fortune 500 CEOs played college sports. And you've mentioned Coach Bo Ryan talking about that, you know, the basketball is super relatable when it comes to life and different things like that. Like you have, and I would say the same is true for anybody that's been around the game for a long time. You've learned a lot of really like cool lessons. You've built a ton of relationships, but you've also learned some hard lessons. I mean, yeah, your agent passed away, like relationships and things like that. And, you know, I don't know how much you want to dive into things like that, but I mean, the things that you've talked about of, hey, I just became a dad. This is probably one of the greatest days, if not the greatest day of my life. And now my agent says like, hey, you know, don't worry. Like we have plenty of time. Just let me know tomorrow. Right, like right. Their view on what time and things like that, like it's different. You're forced to make decisions. You build relationships with people overseas and then you say goodbye and you maybe never see them again. Right. How has the basketball through the good times, the bad, you know, what are some of the things that it has taught you?
Man, there's a million ways I could go with this. Cause there's just so many things that basketball teaches you. Going back to, you know, kind of Coach Ryan, what he taught us and what he was huge on was he would say stuff that I think at first I didn't really get it, but he'd be like, you know, that a great story that kind of sums this up that I love to tell is I think our freshman year at Wisconsin, we had class checkers. Like, so if you showed up late to class or you skipped class, like you had someone there, like basically taking attendance for us, making sure the athletes were showing up to class.
Yeah.
So I'm going with Jordan Taylor. We're both, you know, freshmen together. And Jordan shows up, you know, 10 minutes late to class and he comes in, tries to sneak
really?
In.
Really? Jordan?
Like, right, yeah. Hard to believe. I know. So he shows up and then we get to practice. And we're like, oh man, the class checker had to report him. You know, like we get through film. He's like waiting for Coach Ryan to be like, Jordan, why are we late? You know, he doesn't say anything. We get out on the floor. He's like, I think we're good, man. I think the class checker didn't tell on me. We're like, okay, cool. So we start warming up. We get like halfway through practice. Jordan like throws a turnover, whatever happens. Coach Ryan stops practice. He goes, Jordan, you threw that pass like someone who shows up 10 minutes late to class. And we're like, what? But it was so like, that's the stuff where you're like, what are you talking about? But his whole point is it's responsibility. It's whether you're, you know, on the floor, like taking care of the ball, you know, being in your position defensively, sticking to a scouting report or going to class, you know, doing your homework, being on time, being respectful, responsible, you know. And he would say, he was huge on stuff like that where it's, you know, basketball isn't just teaching you how to be a basketball player. It's teaching you, you know, how to work hard, how to be a team, how to be a, you know, that's going to apply in your job, whether that's a professional basketball player or, you know, an accountant or a teacher or whatever. It's, you know, how you do anything is how you do everything. And that's something I, you know, I find myself trying to pass that message on to, you know, this summer I was running a youth program with at Elk River with like fourth through eighth grade. So it's younger kids. And I started preaching that same message to them. They're goofing around one day. And I stopped and I went on this rant to them like, guys, you're not focused right now. You're not working hard. Like, how you do anything is how you do everything. Like, you guys can't focus and work hard right now. Like, you guys aren't going to be focused and working hard in the classroom. You're not going to get good grades. And that's not to say, you know, you goof around at practice, you're going to be a failure in life. But it's, you know, it's the concepts of, you know, applying that hard work and discipline to everything you do, whether it's, you know, in your job, in your relationships, you know, how you're going to be as a future husband, father, you know, coworker, whatever it is. And, you know, that was all lessons instilled in me from Coach Ryan that I find myself, you know, like I said, I didn't get it at first, but it's, it's so true. And I fully believe that, you know, all these lessons you learn in sports are, you know, applicable to everything you do.
No, totally. I love how you said that. Like, you, the fact that you, in the moment, you might not necessarily be aware, but looking back, like, wow, you know, that had an impact on me. You know, we have some segments that I think this is a great opportunity to transition into. And one of them is 2020, right? This idea that hindsight's 2020, and, you know, sports, specifically basketball in this case, you know, has brought a lot into your life. You know, you mentioned Coach Ryan and his impact, but, you know, looking back, can you give us an example of someone else that maybe you didn't realize at the time, but you look back and say, wow, that person had a huge impact on my career?
Yeah, I think I can go kind of two ways with this. The first one, to focus on a specific individual. One guy was one of my teammates in Italy, David Moss, where honestly, thinking back, he's one of my favorite teammates ever. And he wasn't a guy that, you know, I wasn't super close with. Like, we didn't like hang out a ton off the court.
Yeah.
But he was a guy that just came to work every day, was super intense. Like, if he was on the other team when you're scrimmaging in practice, like, you hated to play against him. Because he was, you know, he's talking trash, but he's doing it in a way to just to light a fire in you and get you to compete, you know. And when he's on your team, like, so one day he's on the other team and he's like, oh, you can't score that, you can't, you know, and it's like he's trying to get under your skin.
Yeah.
And then the next day he's on your team and he's like, yeah, Burke, you got it, go finish that, you're good. And it's, you know, fully positive, encouraging, you know. But it was just his mentality and his approach. Yeah, like I said, I maybe didn't see it at the time. There's times when it, you know, maybe annoyed me, or, you know, if he was on my team, I loved it. But it was, I think, his approach and his, there's just some little things about, like, the way he, you know, just came to work every day. He took care of his body every day. He's still playing with the same team in Italy. He's probably, I don't know, 34, 35 years old now, like, been doing this for a long time. But he was just relentless in everything that he did. And I think I try to take some of that, you know, into life now, when it's like, you know, being a dad, like, I'm wake up early, I'm tired, I don't want to get out of bed, I don't want to do this, whatever. And it's like, there's times I literally think about him, like, the way he would approach things, just be like, you got to do it. Yeah. And he just, you know, push himself through it, stay moving, keep working. Yeah. So just little lessons like that. The other thing I would say, not necessarily from a person, but from just events and, you know, circumstances that happened to me, that have been really beneficial, was, you know, my rookie year, I kind of started hitting my stride, you know, around a little before Christmas of my rookie year. Went through the first couple months trying to figure out a new system, new style of play, new, you know, nuances in the rules in Europe. Kind of started hitting my stride, playing really well. Got like player of the week a couple times in the Euro Cup and like Belgian League. And then the next week we're playing on the road, Euro Cup, tore my meniscus. And it wasn't even, it wasn't like a, you know, one movement, I felt it pop, nothing like that. It was like the next day after the game, man, my knee is really sore. Like, I don't know what happened. Kept trying to play through it. Knee started swelling up, really bugging me. You know, found out I had a torn meniscus. Had to get it, you know, small surgery, get it cleaned up. Come back to play. Starts hurting again, swelling up again. Same thing, tore again. So after I played through the rest of the season on it, when I came home, that summer, I went back. So when I initially heard it, I came back to Chicago, worked with the surgeon that works with the Chicago Bulls, done like, you know, tons of NBA guys, knee surgeries. So really a top-notch guy. And he's like, yeah, pretty routine. We'll clean it up. You'll be good to go. When it happens again, I go back in the summer. He's like, yeah, this is just, you know, some guys just don't handle it well. Their knees just kind of keep breaking down. And he's like, oh, but you're, you know, you're a smart guy, right? Like, you got a good education. Like, you'll be, you know, you'll be good if you can't play. I left his office just in tears. I'm like, yeah. I just finished my rookie year. I'm sitting here thinking I'm going to play for, you know, 5-10 years. I don't know. Like, I might do this forever. Yeah. And then it's like, okay, this was a very eye-opening thing where it was like, basketball doesn't last forever was one part of it. Another part is just, all right, I got to do everything I can to take care of my body. So that was, you know, before practice, not just walking on the court and jumping out and playing. It was, all right, let's do some little activation exercises to get ready to go and, you know, do all the little recovery things to get me ready, you know, after a hard workout, after a hard game, get me ready for the next day because, it, you know, the grind doesn't stop. So yeah. It was, I really learned a lot from those, you know, what could be looked at as a negative experience, you know, getting injuries, having, you know, 2 knee surgeries my first year playing professionally.
Yeah, really.
But I'm thankful for, you know, in hindsight, I'm kind of thankful for it that, it, you know, I learned a ton about how to take care of my body. And then another part, you know, experiences like we talked about in Japan, you know, just going through struggles. When I was really losing my confidence, I actually went through, and I haven't really talked to anyone about this except my wife. When I was really struggling like that, one aspect that, you know, maybe don't have to dive super deep into is just, you know, my relationship with God and my religion, my faith.
Uh-huh.
Struggles kind of brought me back to, you know, a stronger faith, I would say. And another thing was just learning about my mind and how your mind works. I did some online mental training programs where it was just trying to identify your thoughts. I think there's a big movement on that too, like the mindfulness training, meditation, stuff like that, where I got into that a little bit. And that's really on the forefront of, you know, mental health, which is a kind of a hot topic, you know, in 2020 like this. But it kind of taught me about that. And then now I think it helps me as a trainer because I see kind of the patterns or the body language of things when someone's just not right and they're beating themselves up and they're, you know, we're going through drills and they're missing shots and I hear them like, oh, you suck. Like, oh, you can't shoot. It's like, dude, like, listen to what you're saying to yourself uh-huh. right now. Like your brain is wired in a way that you say something over and over like that. Like you start to believe that.
Yeah.
So I'm like be positive with yourself, you know? So I think it's really helped me as a trainer, to be able to identify that stuff and, you know, kind of preach positivity to people that, you know, you're going to make mistakes, but let's push through it and let's identify those negative thoughts and find ways to, you know, be positive with yourself to improve, you know? So I'm kind of thankful for those struggles, both physically with my injuries and, you know, mentally with my struggles. Cause I think it's, you know, it's taught me a lot that's going to be beneficial in this kind of next phase of my career of transitioning from being a player to being a trainer.
I couldn't agree more with that. And I was challenged a couple weeks ago by my dad. Actually, two things. My pastor, Troy Dobbs, who's a basketball nut. His son, Drake, is committed to Liberty, and Drake's around the gym in the summer. But Troy made a comment, a couple things. He said, do you think about what you think about? Like, right. Do we ever go back at the end of the day? And that was one thing that Brad Davison and I talked about. Is like, do you ever audit your thoughts? Like, it's, you know, you might be in a bad mood and then that bad mood lasts for 2 days and then 4 days and then 8 days. And the next thing you know, like you've just been a jerk for 2 weeks, like, or we've been, you know, in that type of environment. And so like, do you think about what you think about? And then my dad challenged me with, he said, you know, from a faith standpoint and, you know, really believing in God's provisions for your life and how often that is skewed. We think that there's a snake. If God is going to protect me, that means that he is going to protect me from the snake. But a lot of times he's going to let the snake bite us. He's just not going to let the snake kill us. And and our life is the learning process, and all of those experiences happen after the snake bite. You know, you got bit in Japan.
Right.
When you got released, you got bit overseas when you tore your meniscus, you got bit leaving that doctor's office. Oh, you're a smart kid. You know, you got a Wisconsin degree. And those are all times in your life where you're forced to, you're forced to respond. And I think too, you know, as we kind of go into part two of this 2020 segment, you know, and you've mentioned this a little bit and we talked about it, but you know, for me personally, the game of basketball, like I look at my best friends, the people that I'm around, they're all guys that I've met through the game. Right. And so, you know, how your time, like going through learning these lessons, all these things, how has the game of basketball impacted your life off the court?
Man, I mean, I think you can, you know, go back to what we talked about a little bit with just, you know, kind of the brotherhood we have at Wisconsin and just that whole family dynamic with, yep. you know, the trainers, the coaches, the players, the managers, all this stuff that, you know, I keep in touch with. And, you know, if I see them, you know, once in 2 years, 3 years, it's like, oh, hey, like give a big hug. Like, how are you? It's like, you know, it's like, you didn't skip a beat. You're just back to, you know, cracking the old jokes and having fun with each other. And so I think that, yeah, like you said, like just the connections you make has really shaped, you know, who I've been and who I'm around, even back to high school. Like my best friends from high school are the ones I played sports with, you know, and that's just the bond you make through playing sports. And then, you know, the life lessons, the concept of hard work, of dedication, of responsibility, all that stuff, even, you know, learning how to take care of my body, not even necessarily from an athletic standpoint, but just from a general living standpoint. Like I value fitness. I value, you know, eating healthy for the most part. I mean, we just kind of got through the holiday stretch here where, you know, I've kind of been on call for the last, 11 years of, you know, 5 years of college and 6 years overseas, where through Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, it's like, all right, well, I can't go too crazy because, you know, I got practice today or tomorrow. So this year I did enjoy myself a little bit more. But it's, you know, I value fitness and health, you know? So it's like, if I go a weekend of, you know, eating, you know, pizza and potato chips, I'm like, okay, I feel like junk. I need to eat healthy. I need to get a good workout in. And that's, you know, not necessarily even for my, you know, my job as a trainer now of being able to stay fit so I can be on the court and help kids get better. But it's, you know, just my general life. I think I'd apply that even if I, you know, if I ended up in a desk job someday, it's like, okay, I'm not going to let my body go to trash, you know, because that's something I value now. And I think that's very important for your physical and mental well-being. I think you just, you know, a fit body just, you know, applies to your mind as well. That I know I feel a lot better when I'm physically active and, you know, it's just become a lifestyle for me, which I think is important.
Yeah, that's great. You know, the idea behind this podcast and the name, The Drawing Board, you know, spending time as a college coach, whenever something wasn't working, you kind of joke and say the phrase, well, let's go back to the drawing board. We've, you know, used that phrase quite a bit. And I think the answer to this question is super valuable, but how do you adjust when something isn't working? Like, how do you approach that? How do you audit yourself? You know, you just talked about like fitness, but like just mentally, like if something's not going how you want it to go, when you need to go back to the drawing board, how do you go about that?
I mean, that's a good question. I think just some of the stuff I've learned about, identifying thought patterns and thought processes. It's, you know, and what you talked about too is, you know, do you think about what you think about? You know, it's like, I'm in a slump here and it's like, everything's going negative. It's like, all right, let's find a time. I find, you know, like I said, just tying in like physical fitness, being productive, like making a list. I mean, this is something kind of goofy me and my wife do that even when we were overseas and we were kind of going through like hard times, we'd have a day off and it's like, all right, what are we going to do? We can't just sit here and be miserable. So it's like, we would make a list of all these like little, like meaningless things, but we'd literally make a list and be like, we're going to eat breakfast and then we're going to do the dishes. Then we're going to do some laundry and then we're going to go for a walk and then we're going to go. And it'd be like, we'd literally write these things out and cross it out. Cause just the feeling of accomplishing something, like it builds momentum into bigger things. So it's, and I've heard a lot of this too with, you know, very successful people talking about, you know, making your bed in the morning is a habit that many successful yes. people do, which I actually do not ever do. But regardless, the concept is, you know, it's starting with small tasks and accomplishing something, and, you know, it builds momentum into bigger things. So it's like, oh, I have this project I got to do. I have this, you know, this camp I got to plan that I'm at a, you know, just hitting the wall with how am I going to organize this? How am I going to, you know, what am I going to do with these kids? Like on a training side thing, it's like, there's times where you kind of hit a wall and it's like, all right, let's take a step back. Let's just build some momentum into, you know, something productive to find a way to get stuff done. And I think that's a, you know, you can apply it to anything, you know, kind of as I've talked about this, like it's, you know, it's applicable to your job, your hobbies, like your relationships. Like just find little victories to build momentum and kind of build from there, no matter what you're trying to get done.
Awesome. I think that's all great stuff. I want to do our last segments just kind of rapid fire really quickly. Put you on the spot, blurt out what, you know, first thing that comes to mind. You know, we're big in social media just because we connect with a lot of people. I mean, it's 2020. That's how you got to connect in this day and age. I see a lot of good stuff, see a lot of bad stuff out there. Who's your favorite follow on social media and why? If you got someone different on Instagram or Twitter or whatnot, you can go with a couple, but very quickly, who's your favorite follow and why?
I'll take it in a positive way. I think social media can be a good or bad thing. And I think I have a mix of, you know, wasting time with stupid memes and funny stuff. But in a positive way, it can be super beneficial. I think guys like DJ Sackman, who yep. you actually worked with out East, is just awesome. The educational content he posts from a training perspective. So his account and his other account, Hoop Study, where they really break down, you know, footwork behind moves and different training techniques and stuff like that is super beneficial. Jordan Lawley's another guy that posts some really great stuff. So I spend a lot of time, and I think it kind of bugs my wife at times. It's like, I'm on my phone, I'm on Instagram, and she's like, will you stop just screwing around? I'm like, honestly, I'm learning right now. It's goofy. I get it. Cause it's like, I'm sitting here, I'm on my phone probably way too much. And, you know, especially with my daughter, who's about 2.5 now, wanting my attention. It's like, but there's also times it's like, I'm still, you know, relatively new to this training game. I mean, I've been working with you and learning from you for about 4 years now. But in terms of doing it on my own, I'm still learning how to teach things. So I see some of this content that these guys provide, and I'm like, that's a great point they make. That's a great way to break this down. And, you know, so I'm trying to always learn from stuff there. Where, like I said, social media can be, you know, a huge time waste, or it can be hugely beneficial. It's all about how you use it. So those are a couple of guys that are very beneficial to me.
Awesome. Who's the toughest player you've ever guarded?
That's a really good question too. I would say, I mean, the best player now would be Kristaps Porzingis.
Yeah.
Like I said, when I played against him in Spain, at the time he was, you know, I think probably 17, 18 years old and, you know, super skinny. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't, you know, he wasn't the toughest at the time, but you could see he had the potential to, you know, to be a monster. I would say maybe the toughest was, Jared Sullinger.
Yeah.
When he was at Ohio State, I mean, he was a monster, and just matchup wise for me, he was a little bit shorter of a big guy and big, you know, thick body, strong, that, you know, I'm tall and skinny, you know, so for me to try to bang in the post with him was, you know, very good challenge. I think I had a couple good games. I think he got the best of me a couple times and I got the best of him maybe once. But it was he was definitely a real tough matchup for me.
In, you know, I know that you're a Wisconsin Badger guy, but you're a Minnesota sports fan. The Vikings got smacked.
Typical.
I need your Minnesota moment. Which terrible Minnesota sports moment haunts you the most? For me, and back in the day, Gary Anderson being perfect all year. Oh. I was at Fuddruckers. Oh. I know. I remember exactly where I was when he missed it. Jamal Anderson, the Dirty Bird, like, get out of my dreams.
Yes. No, I mean, well, you stole my answer there, because I think that's everyone in our, you know, our generation, our, you know.
He was perfect the whole year.
I was 8 years old watching this game. Doesn't miss all year long. We're what, 15-1 through the regular season?
Yeah, rolling.
This is our year. We're rolling. Get to the NFC Championship. Hasn't missed. Money. Here we go. And he misses. First time all year.
Oh my.
Heartbreak. God. I remember sitting on the floor at, you know, in my parents' basement and sitting there with this big, we had these big gray pillows. And I'm sitting there like laying on my stomach, propped up on this pillow, and he misses it. I remember just burying my head in this pillow and just crying.
That was awful.
Crying like a baby. It was the worst. Which this is actually very funny. I literally had a dream last night that pretty much that situation. It wasn't, you know, exact details like that. That the Vikings kicked a field goal to win the Super Bowl. And I remember running around like on the verge of tears. My wife was like in the dream. She's looking at me like, you are a lunatic. And then I woke up and was like, wait, I'm still a Minnesota sports fan. So that's obviously fake.
Yeah. I did think it was interesting. I hope this is taken the right way. I do not mean any offense. I have a ton of respect and I love working with females. But you have the Target Center, downtown Minneapolis. And a couple of years ago, when the Lynx were in the middle of winning all of their titles, like they're the only sports team that's ever had any success. And you go on Google Maps and over the top, it didn't say Target Center. It said Minnesota Lynx. And I'm like, this is hilarious because the Timberwolves have played here for about 15 years longer. Not that that matters or anything, but I was like, I wish I could have been in the room when someone was like, yo, we got to switch this, man. Because someone had to make a conscious effort to be like, it says Minnesota Timberwolves. We need it to say Lynx.
Right. That's awesome.
That is funny.
It is, man. It's their house.
There's one more
story that I think that's the one every Minnesota sports fan goes to. I mean, that's like the biggest heartbreak ever for us. Another one that was big for me was, I can't remember the exact year. I think it might have been the same year. It was like 98, right around there. The Timberwolves, KG was just kind of coming up. They were starting to build some there. They made the playoffs the year before. I think they got like swept or they lost pretty bad. The next year they went in a series with the Sonics.
Sonics.
Right?
Yeah.
Seattle Sonics when they were out there. They went to like game five, big series, and ended up losing game five on the road. And I remember like staying at my friend's house, my neighbor's house. So I was staying up late watching the game. You know, I was out in Seattle, so it was like a late game. Staying up, watching it, losing a heartbreak there. And I remember, like, yeah, similar experience for me. Like, Timberwolves just can't get over the hump and win a playoff series. And they went, you know, quite a few more years after that before they finally did win a series. But that was another one that's, you know, a little bit more under the radar that was really painful for me as a young fan.
Yeah, well, and I think from the NFL, from the Vikings standpoint, the fact that Paul Allen, like, if you win a game, Paul Allen, the play-by-play guy, I think he's probably the best. I mean, like you might not like him, but like he's like he has the voice, and like, you know, Favre hitting Greg Lewis or the Minneapolis Miracle, all of those great moments are like awesome. And then in defeat, he like will scream no, like if he, like you, like I'm sure there's something on YouTube of like Paul Allen just screaming no in the booth. Or I think there was even one time when it was like guy got sacked, or I don't know if it was Poole. I think Poole from Arizona in the back of the end zone to knock them out of the playoffs when the Cardinals weren't even going to the playoffs.
Terrible. Yeah.
And I think he was just like, he screamed no, or there was another situation where he was just like, and the quarterback is sacked and the season is over. And it was so not like, and you're just like, I want to go lock myself in a room in the dark for the next 2 weeks. Paul Allen just made me depressed.
Yeah, that's why he's great, though, because he's all of us.
Yep.
He is Minnesota sports fan right there, just wearing your heart on your sleeve. And it's a cycle of the Vikings do just enough to get your hopes up, get you to start to believe. I try to be, you know, hesitant about it. I'm not going to buy in. And it's like we win a big game. It's like, oh, this could be the year, and heartbreak. And it's a vicious cycle. But that's life as a Minnesota sports fan. So it's fun.
I do.
Also, you know what? It's kind of been the Badger like football team too. They've been doing that to me too. Every year, like this year, they're great. Defense is unbelievable. Then they go lose a game.
Illinois, dude.
And it's like, if we would have won that, we could have been, you know, as we ended up losing to Ohio State twice anyways. But it's like, they're always right at the door. And it's just like, let's just kick this thing down and get over the hump. But it's, that's sports, man. Only one team can win. Only one fan base can truly be happy at the end of the year. So
I do know there's a college basketball referee that does stuff in Minnesota that I guess is a diehard Vikings fan. I can't confirm this, but I was told that he has a purple truck and all of that. Season ticket holder.
Nice.
He missed Stephon Diggs's the Minneapolis Miracle.
Wow.
Because he was in anticipation of Minnesota sports fan heartbreak, walked out of his seat, and I guess was in like the rotunda area. I can't even talk. and hearing the like how Minnesota-esque is that? Like, right. Your super fan like leaves and the greatest play in Vikings history happens. Anyway, I think this has been good. This has been fun to have you on. Like we said, you know, Jared works with Catalyst, does an awesome job running camps, running youth stuff, working with our pro guys. Just really good. I think Jared has a bright future in the industry because he is willing to learn. And so, Jared, thanks for coming on. We will have you back on soon.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun to finally put this into fruition here. We've been talking about putting some content out on guys, you know, via podcasts like this. So good to kind of tell our story in a different route here and, you know, just kind of share what we have with you guys. So thanks for having me.
That was Jared Bergeron, former Wisconsin Badger and current skills trainer with Catalyst Training. I have been super excited to get Jared on the podcast because he has an incredible story. The overseas life as a basketball player is not as glamorous as it might appear. The uncertainty of what is next, how does this impact my family, not speaking the same language, all the way down to the food that's made in other countries and not being able to eat what you want after a long day of practice or a big game. You know, playing overseas basketball is not a vacation. It's a job. But that job and the travel has helped mold Jared into someone that I am very proud to have representing the Catalyst brand. We'll see you next time.